Hello again, everybody. Our next panel is going to be a little bit different from the previous ones, and we've designed it to be a lively debate on the tension between an individual's right to know about the things going on in the community around them versus the right to privacy for individuals and companies in those same communities. We have the perfect moderator for the session. This is Jonathan Zittrain, who is a faculty member at the law school and also the executive director and co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Jonathan has for 15 years been the SysOp of SysOps at CompuServe. If you don't know what a SysOp is, as I didn't until about 10 minutes ago, please see Charlie Nesson after the session. He's also one of the very active initial and continuing participants of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which Charlie tells me is the Internet version of the Registry of Deeds. We are grateful to several people, Antoine Vizanot, Marita Nakaki, John Palfrey, and Kim Thompson for their assistance in preparing the mock website that will be featured in the session. Ben Edelman will be assisting Jonathan with navigating the site. Thank you very much.
I feel like I should say oye, oye, oye or something, but the justices are staggering out a little less orderly than they usually do. So, welcome. Our panel has a somewhat unusual format today. We're going to have it be highly interactive and explore together a hypothetical or set of hypothetical situations, asking some of these very real people to react in real time to the questions that are put before us. I see Mindy Luber is the last taker seat. Thank you very much. We're basing our hypothetical around a website of sorts, and Benjamin Edelman, who is steering over here, can pull it up. It's the hypothetical Gotham City website. You see there you can get a welcome from the mayor, who looks like somebody I know, I'm not sure whom, and I am the fortunate person who is the chief information officer of Gotham City, and have been saddled with a number of very tough issues that I'm hoping the people on this panel and ultimately the audience can help us solve. So the first question, you see there are two new areas on this site. The first has to do with the environment. And we are lucky to have with us Mindy Luber from the Environmental Protection Agency, but even before she can say it, because government people always say this, she's only speaking for herself. Whatever she says has nothing to do with what the EPA might actually believe, such as it is.
That frees me up a lot.
Yeah, please, consider yourself very relaxed. So thank you very much for being with us. Now, there is something called worst case scenario data. It sounds like a movie that would be rated at least PG-13. Tell us, what is worst-case scenario data?
Well, let me just back up a tiny bit in that the EPA spends an enormous amount of time putting all kinds of data, and many people think different sets of our data are worst-case scenario data. We clearly have entered the information age, enormous amounts of information going up on the web, air pollution, emissions from local plants, things done zip code by zip code by zip code with a very key end goal of citizens and neighborhoods having a right to have more information and make information that has an impact on their children, their lives, their families, their neighborhoods. Do they want to live next to a plant and so on? So there is no doubt that we have a strong and aggressive position to move information out into the communities.
So you collect stuff from, say, a power plant that has smoke coming out of a chimney, and you demand of that plant to measure how much smoke is coming out and give that information to you, and then you might pass that along to the public.
Right, and it's more than might. We will pass that along to the public. We want people in neighborhoods to know if there is a plant down the block, and I don't care if it's a chemical plant or a utility plant, or a plant processing sludge, or a plant burning municipal waste, what's coming out of that smokestack and what's coming out of the pipe behind the plant is something that has a very real, direct, and personal impact on people's lives, and they have a right to know what it is. So they can make a decision of whether they want to live next door to that plant or whether they want to move down the block. People have a right to know. And I will say our policy on that goes pretty far. There are places.
Is there a butt somewhere in here? Where does the worst-case scenario data come in?
And you ask a good question. And I'm going to answer from the EPA to begin with, but I may add a little bit of the nuance of Mindy Luber. The reality is, as is always the case, there is certain information that doesn't immediately go out to the public. Let me give a few examples, one of which is the one you're asking about. One example is we have information, for instance, the Environmental Protection Agency in real life has just done a new reassessment of dioxin. What are the levels of dioxin that people should be exposed to, and what is the meaning of that? We had an analysis that was out some number of years ago. We built policies around that. We built how clean you build up, clean up Superfund sites. We've got a new analysis about to come out. We've got preliminary data. We haven't peer reviewed it. Some say because dioxin is so potentially dangerous and because it's turning up in streams and rivers near our own houses that we should put that preliminary data out right now before it gets peer reviewed. I would say to you, I don't know if it's right. I want 10 more scientists to look at it.
So you're saying you can't tell us what that data says? You couldn't announce it right here?
Well, I would tell you the following. We're seeing results that suggest that despite the fact that we thought dioxin was a serious problem and ought not to be out there in our communities, we are determining that it is likely a little bit more serious than we thought. And the reality is, I would love to run to every single person who might be near dioxin contamination, but I don't know for certain whether that new analysis has been proven true and I know it hasn't been peer reviewed, and we have asked the press and the public to allow us to very quickly get through the process and get the information out as soon as we confirm that information is real.
So you've got information. We know that it sounds pretty bad, but you're not going to show me the data. Instead, I should let my kids play in the backyard, dig holes in the ground, fill it with sand, you know, the whole kid thing. And at some point, the EPA will say, now we know you can officially panic.
Well, I want to tell you to panic when you ought to panic. Let me give you an example, and we will make that as soon as possible. A year and a half ago, we got a phone call from the New York Times and from a number of citizen groups. We understand there are tremendously high levels of dioxin in the Woonasquatucket River in Rhode Island. How do you know, we asked. We understand, we think, we heard.
There's
somebody.
Some three-eyed fish in the river is how they know. But
somebody had some data. We had some very preliminary data that was starting to be alarming. We didn't wait till that data was confirmed and reconfirmed and triple confirmed, but we did get it out for some quick peer review for the very instance you're saying. If you have data and it's alarming and it's going to impact the way people behave, get it out as quickly as possible. But don't get it out in a way that's going to alarm the public if you don't know it's correct. And that's all we ask. That's the but in that instance.
So the dioxin is one example. Again, let me ask a question. What can you tell us about worst-case scenarios?
We're about to go in. No. Worst-case scenario. Worst-case scenario is a whole series of data that the EPA has collected or is in the process of collecting. And a good amount of that data will be made public up on the web. But let me give some examples. Worst-case scenarios may be take a chemical plant and look at every chemical plant using particularly toxic chemicals across the United States and lay out what would happen if a small bomb was dropped on it or there was a major accident outside the plant and the kind of contamination.
This is great. I just get surveys in my office like, you know, how is your computer usage? Are you Y2K compliant? There's somebody at a plant somewhere that has to say what would happen if a big bomb fell on your plant.
We would like to know. We want to be prepared. Now, you ask a good question because I think there is a tremendously valuable and legitimate debate about how much of that information should be up on the web. We worked with our counterparts within the federal government. We've got this thing called the federal family, used to, where law enforcement officials had a very different perspective, and obviously good, smart, public servants are entitled to different opinions. Law enforcement officials thought that our data set went too far, that some of the information on air pollutants, on water pollutants, on contaminants, that we were releasing neighborhood by neighborhood, zip code by zip code in communities was okay. And at some point, some of it was really dangerous for possible terrorist attacks and so on. And the government's got to be prepared for that. I will tell you that last week we were up at an exercise called Operation Top Off, where the government spent $5 to $10 million, with Janet Reno being involved on an hour-by-hour basis, dealing with an exercise in emergencies. What happens in chemical contamination? Or in Colorado, it was bubonic plague. How do you act? How do you react? What do you do? So we take these scenarios very literally. In worst-case scenarios, there were parts of the United States government, the federal officials, at the FBI and the Justice Department, who felt like some information went too far in terms of preparing people who want to do damage to a facility, who want to pick the most ripe facility in the United States of America to go after, and that we had to prescribe and circumscribe that information to some limited extent, and that's what we're doing.
And was the idea that you should limit that information, whether it's at a community meeting or on the internet, or there was some idea that you could give some stuff out in Ottumwa, Iowa, about plants in Ottumwa, Iowa that might blow, but you shouldn't put it on the net at large?
And that's it. And I think that is the right compromise. Despite my more natural inclination to say any information about a person's life should be in that person's hands, and we should have an aggressive right to know mentality, campaign, practices within the government, there is certain information that I think is legitimate to withhold. But I do think where we drew the line, and that is, we are not going to put up on the web every piece of information of worst-case scenarios, the worst chemical plants to go after, the worst contaminants that could do damage. But we will make sure for people in communities who want to know, they could find out from their local officials, they could find out from libraries. We're not going to put it up in one unified fashion across the country on the web.
Okay.
That was the compromise.
Okay. So, Ben, maybe you can put up what appears to them be a worst-case scenario, which is an example. I did this all at the mayor's direction. We put up a little environment page. See, I was at one of those community meetings, and I got some of the data, and I just dumped it into the database, and Ben sat there, and he has a little icon collection. And that looks remarkably like Cambridge. Why don't you click right on Sanders Theater there and just see? All right, so there we are. In the Memorial Hall Labs, you could have a release of up to 100,000 tons of chemicals, and you know, here's a whole bunch of stuff that could happen. Now, Ken Warner, you're a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, a member of the federal family as we know it, somebody associated with law enforcement. Tell me about this compromise. By Mindy's reckoning, depending on exactly what Ben and I have put up here, this could be going too far, because while it's okay to hand out the stuff at physical meetings, somehow to just take that stuff and put it on the internet goes a step too far. Is that a workable compromise to you?
I think we're always concerned with information that's publicly available that can be used against us. And we've had that situation in newsprint here in the Boston area over the last year. I think a year ago there was a publication that basically was a terrorist blueprint of Boston and showed every vulnerable point. And so we're not really unknown to this, although once again, what people can freely print and what we like and don't like doesn't always, you know, we don't always have the basis to say yes or no. So,
but is it tenable to say we're going to pass this stuff out at the community meeting, but we're not going to put it on the web? I mean, what's to stop, if not Gotham City, somebody else, some environmental do-gooder or do-badder, depending on your view? I mean, Jonathan, you're a professor of environmental issues. What's your view here?
Well, I think this is a really interesting and difficult problem. It's a more difficult problem for the federal government than it would be for Gotham City, because the FBI's real concern at the federal level was about providing terrorists one-stop shopping for all the biggest disasters they could cause across the United States. And it would be more difficult for a terrorist organization in Afghanistan or Iraq to search for particular sites like your Gotham City site. Nevertheless, I think you're posing a good question. The compromise that was worked out just a month ago, just proposed by the EPA and the Justice Department on April 27th, is that this information on worst-case scenarios would not be available on the internet, but it would be available in 50 federal reading rooms.
That's my broker. I'm selling. Go ahead.
These worst-case scenarios would be available in 50 federal reading rooms, which would include EPA offices and other federal offices.
This is like the Church of Scientology reading room. You come in off the street, and somebody greets you, welcome to the federal family, you sit down, and then you can't leave with the documents. You have to read them in.
It's read-only, no photocopying. You can't leave with the document. I think the readers would be limited to 10 visits per month. I think that's the way the proposed rule.
And you're not allowed to write on your hand?
You get
frisked on the way out?
I don't think it's quite as restrictive as the Harvard archives. But
believe me, if some people knew it was in there, we could have riots in the streets.
Now you can only bring pencils, not pens, and so forth. Yes, you have to sign in. Now, it's unclear to me from the proposed rule whether the sign-in names would be shared nationally. That is, whether the federal reading rooms would keep track of whether people signed in just at their reading room or everywhere. Plus, there would be availability under the proposed compromise for local fire departments and other local agencies of that kind to make this information available. But EPA and Justice are just proposing this, and they're requesting comment on all of these aspects, including comment on whether the local fire departments ought to be able to provide this information.
This is fascinating.
If I could just add one thing. This strategy of using information to protect the environment that Mindy Lubbers described has been very effective. So the benefits of providing information to the community and thereby getting facilities to be safer and to reduce their emissions seems to have been very effective over the last 10 or 15 years. And it's only when Congress added a provision in 1990 that required the worst-case scenarios, not just the day-to-day routine emissions, but the worst-case scenario of a terrible accident at every facility. That's what got the FBI very concerned. And then this information was legally obliged to be put on the net. It wasn't EPA's decision to put it on the net. The Electronic Freedom of Information Act required it to be put on the web. And it was only a special act of Congress passed a year ago that restricted this information from being put onto the web until EPA and DOJ put their heads, and EPA and the Justice Department, FBI, put their heads together and figured out what to do about it.
Came up with the federal reading room.
Right.
I love it. How many people here would go to the federal reading room? Ben would go, right? Ben's going to have a hidden spy camera and then put it up on the net. Representative St. Fleur. Hi there. You represent Dorchester, right?
Dorchester and Roxbury.
Dorchester and Roxbury. Tell me what you think of this compromise. Is it something that your constituents would want to know about? If there's some kind of plant, always has those closed gates, you have no idea what goes on inside. EPA has collected some information about potential dangers that could come about if lightning were to strike the plant. Is that something your constituents are going to want to know? And if so, are they going to want to go to a reading room to find it out?
Well, you know, I think my constituents may want to know what particular harmful pollutants are present at the site, which would have an immediate and direct impact on their quality of life. I think that is accurate. Now, as to whether or not they would agree that it should be on some web for everyone from here to anywhere in the world to read, I'm not sure that they would say that is really necessary. I think what they'd want is an opportunity to be told so that they could take the corrective measures. I think most of us would understand that there has to be a balance between an individual's right to know and the realistic needs that we have as a society and with respect to the protection of our country. And to the extent that we allow this information out without any filters or without any sort of protective measures, I think it puts all of us at risk. So I think, whether or not they would go to a reading room, I'm not sure that my individual constituents would go to a reading room, but I would sure that ACE probably would go to that reading room, and that's, you know, we have environmental watchdogs everywhere.
But these watchdogs can't sit back and massage the data at their leisure on a computer or something. These watchdogs now have to fan out across the country. They get 7 visits each. They have to recruit volunteers.
Well,
perhaps people who are good at memorizing things to go in and get the data and come out and report it down to extract this stuff, right?
Not based upon what I am hearing here. I think it is community specific. And I think that is important. And I think that there are other ways in order through maybe a freedom of information request or what have you, in order to be able to get some of the information, which may not necessarily require that they sit at that reading room for an additional 10 or more. There may be other legal mechanisms available to them so that they can get...
Although the national security people are going to fight against those mechanisms as much as they might against anything else,
I think,
right?
That's part of the process, and I think we do have to respect some of that process to the extent that it does provide the protections that we need in terms of national security.
So one thought might be, this is an attractive target we hear then for those who might want to do something bad, not just those who want to know about what's in their neighborhood. And if you put something on the internet, on a website, say, you can get some sense of who's looking at it, right? I mean, Ben, you can call up logs that say, here's who's been looking at this stuff at one point or another. And then I assume you can transform these logs into some kind of map, a map that could tell you, here are the sites around the world that is looking at this stuff. And I see over here, Ben has gone to the trouble of coming up with, we've had 17 searches performed from Iraq, 142 from Libya, and 46 from Cuba. Now, Ken, I'm just wondering, FBI.gov. Somebody goes and visits FBI.gov. Do they have license to be collecting stuff like this?
Well, I'm not sure that we have full control over what information is out there. If it's in the public domain, I think we're pretty much at the peril of the people that are using the information. So it's very difficult for us. And obviously, national security is a major concern, and it's an issue with us. But I'm not sure we're able to control it.
I mean, I just wonder if this might not be news we could use. You just as you have the sign in to the reading room here, you've even got a better, more reliable form of sign in, right, Jonathan?
Yeah, the, I think an interesting point here is that we need to compare the access to this information without the internet to the access to the information with the internet. And if the risk is of terrorist use of this information that they could get without using the internet, of course the terrorist organization would have to fan out across the country and send their people, and they might have to sign in, but it might be much harder to track where they were coming from. Whereas if you could, if the internet's not anonymous, which I thought I heard people earlier saying that it is anonymous, but
we don't know who they were.
There are devices, there are anonymity devices. But if you could figure out which one of these are Osama bin Laden, then that might be helpful in infiltrating and preventing the terrorist attack.
In fact, you could salt it with some fake data, right? Say, here's the site you want to hit.
EPA would never put out fake data.
Go back for a moment to the value of the information and what's important. Community right to know, people's right to know, and individuals' right to know where they're living, what they're living next to, what they're living around, what their children are playing in, that is a very real and legitimate right. We ought to make sure that if somebody wants this information we're talking about, they could go to their local fire chief or their local police chief or the people who will be responsible for dealing with worst-case scenarios should they happen. And so, while it's a fine line, and I'm less comfortable with withholding information than I am with giving it out, there are sometimes legitimate needs, and as long as your eye is on the ball, a very conscious analysis of can people who need the information get access to it, are they being protected, are the people who have to act on it getting access to it, I think you take a tough problem, and we get these problems every day in our lives, all of us, and have cut it just about the right way. Again, we'll get plenty of comment. Everyone in this room should comment. But it is a balancing of the interests.
I'll take that as an invitation and exercise.
Nadine Strossen, ACLU, give us a comment.
Exercise free speech while it still exists. I'm really appalled. In a free country, the so-called rationale that information might be abused, that it might fall into hands that would make a nefarious use of it as a justification for depriving citizens, not to mention other government officials, not to mention academic researchers, not to mention
Please hold your applause until the end of the panel.
I mean, if the rationale that information could be misused was enough to justify suppressing it, we wouldn't have a Freedom of Information Act. We wouldn't have public libraries. But for that matter, we wouldn't have automobiles. Talk about new technology. When cars were first invented, Ken Warner's counterparts in the FBI and law enforcement at the time said, well, that's a bad, dangerous invention. It will allow criminals to escape from the police. Let's not let it
be produced.
Come on,
did they really say that?
They really, really said that. They really, really said that.
Like the FBI was Hoover, and the cars were Ford.
We should point out, J. Edgar Hoover wrote a very notable article saying that motels were the end of law enforcement as we know it, because they were safe havens.
He may have had a point, but freedom reigns.
And obviously, I think what's particularly appalling about this kind of situation is that not only are we talking about serious violations of freedom of speech, but also privacy in terms of having to forfeit your anonymity to perhaps it's a potential whistleblower who's going after this information. Perhaps it's a potential litigant, somebody who is going to be deterred from exercising other legal rights because of having to forfeit anonymity. But I think this is also a situation where we're not talking about a trade-off of civil liberties on the one hand versus security on the other hand. The best security against any kind of dangerous activity, including accidents that happen at these facilities. And we know by far the greater danger is accidents that are happening internally, dwarf any actual terroristic threat in terms of what the actual history and record has been. The best way to protect us against that real danger, as opposed to the always really scary abstract possibility of the big T word, the best way to protect us is to get the information out there, and not only to the local community, but your citizens and your constituents will best be able to evaluate the information they're getting about their local facilities if they can compare it to a national database. They'll have better ideas about how to take protective measures by getting information nationwide. So even if your concern is purely local, you want the information to be available on a national scale.
I guess the reaction that I'm having, I didn't hear that the information is not going to be available. I think that the information, the way that you're going to be able to get to the information is going to be tailored in order to provide some protections. Now, I think if we look at what's been happening in the world in the past 3 or 4 years, we can't predict anymore. We don't have the kind of world where we can predict nicely that we will not have any difficulties. Look at what's happening to our schools. What we're saying is give the information, but provide some measure of protection so that the people in my district are not going to want to sit through and sift through EPA data. They're not. Like I said, ACE may very well want to. We want to be able to have ACE to have that ability because they have a legitimate reason for being able to get that information. The people in my district do want to know if there's lead in the soil, if there is an incinerator in the neighborhood that is going to harm their children, then tell them that it's there so that they could take the protective measures. Do they really want to sit there and analyze worst case scenario? In all honesty, does the everyday person really want that information? What is the audience for that information? And to the extent that you don't really have that audience out there, if I am the person sitting in my home today and want that information, how can I access it? Now, a right to First Amendment, yes, it is a right. What it does say is, I have the right to access the information. It is not a right that we can look at irregardless of what the consequences are in other. So the idea that let's just throw the information out there and let's hope it happens, that nothing happens, I think is a little bit unrealistic in terms of the world that we're living in right now. And all we have to do is look at the unpredictability of what's happened in Newton, what's happened in Columbine, and that's local. And now we're going to give that access out there to whoever wants to pick it up and use it.
Okay. I think a lot of the points that you're making actually support the conclusion I'm arguing for. The audience for this information precisely includes environmental activists, includes local firefighters, includes local citizen emergency protection groups, whose whole purpose is to use that information, A, to prevent a dangerous act from happening, B, to lobby those who really do have power to take safety measures that will prevent either a terrorist occurrence or an accident. And let's not forget that far more lives and limbs have been endangered by the failure of these companies to take protective measures. And what does ultimately drive them to do it is the power of public opinion driven by information about the potential risk.
So to be sure I understand your position, you say the greater the potential hazard, the more important it is to get the stuff out there far and wide so that public opinion can work in its ways and people can massage the data and maybe even change the tinderbox that if lit could blow hard, because now we know the tinderbox is there. So if there's a public hazard out there, we've got to let the public know. With that said, let me shift to another area of our website for which I'd like to get some views. Let's see, we have something new in crime. It looks like there's some data that's available under a new law by which those who have been tried and convicted of a particular kind of crime are listed in a database because they are believed to be themselves hazards of a sort. And I believe here we have a map in which we have taken all that data that's so hard to understand and tried to put it in a graphical representation. And then if you click on one of the hazard points, you'll see, all right, so here's a name, Alan D. Smith. Alan D. Smith, are you? No, good, all right. Alan D. Smith, 5'9", gender M. He is somebody registered in this offenders database. And it had been, you'd have to go to the local police station to get this information. Now, before you even move into a community, you can find out what the hazards are here. Nadine, you agree with me?
I absolutely oppose the posting of the surprise, surprise. You know, I said in response to, very, very carefully in response to the previous question, that there we were talking about something that violated both freedom of speech and privacy, and in my view, as Jonathan so well summarized at the end, also endangered public safety. So I thought all of the factors that we were concerned about, all of the interests, were mutually reinforced and supported by getting the information out there. In this situation, that is not true. There is a clear conflict between information and another very important civil liberties interest, namely privacy. And I also do not think that public safety is advanced by putting this information out there.
But isn't that you making a judgment on behalf of the people who you were saying before, get the information out there and the truth will out. I mean, this is perfectly publicly available information. This guy was convicted of a crime.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not going to bring any kind of legal action against somebody who is putting that information there, unless it's the government, and then I would bring the challenge that has been brought against similar laws for a violation of individual privacy.
But even there, weren't those laws requiring a continuing registration as somebody moved around? What if our site was a little less ambitious and just said, at the time they were convicted, this is where they lived?
I think, you know, in addition to the privacy concerns, let's be very pragmatic here, because I would imagine myself in Representative St. Floor's position. What do my constituents care about? Obviously, they care about having information that is going to serve. I think we have to ask, what legitimate public purpose is that information going to serve versus what is the damage, including to individual privacy? privacy and safety when we think of potential vigilantism and other hostile acts against the person whose name is listed there. And here I think the balance is actually quite an easy one, although it is a judgment that would have to be made by courts and other public officials. The reason why I think the balance is an easy one is if people are going to rely on this kind of information as giving them relevant information about somebody who will be a continuing danger, and B, only about all such people, they are getting a false sense of danger. Many people who have been convicted and have this kind of record are not, in fact, going to pose continuing threats to public safety. And number two, they're going to get a false sense of security because they won't take adequate safety precautions against people who might, in fact, endanger them or their children. If you take the example of sexual offenders, which is, of course, what has driven this kind of law in real life all over the country, in fact, the sad statistics continue to show that the vast majority of sexual abuse against children is committed by somebody who has never even been arrested, let alone somebody who's actually been convicted.
So is there anybody on the panel willing to go to bat for a site like this? Anybody willing to say, if not, this is a public good, let the public decide how much of a good it is?
I'm not sure Caitlin. I'm willing to go to bat for it. And I should also avail myself of the same broad disclaimer.
Caitlin works for the New York Attorney General's office, and everything she's about to say